Your thoughts. Yeah, I want my normal life back. I want you to come home. I want Mom to be happy. I want us all to be happy. How about the fried shrimp? Dad is talking about food. She looks up to see that at least he's apparently snapped out of his own glum mood. I was thinking lobster, she tells him. Can I? With battered French fries? Sure. I was thinking the same thing. With a side of potato salad and coleslaw, though. It's too hot for fries. Mom made homemade fries one night at the beach house when it rained, Tess informed him, in case he was wondering. He doesn't seem to have been wondering, because he blinks and says blandly, That's nice. Yeah, she's been cooking a lot. She makes great potato salad, too, remember? Maybe she'll make it this weekend. I doubt she'll cook just for herself. Oh, she's got a bunch of friends, Tess hears herself say, and wonders why. But suddenly, Dad looks interested. She does? Who are they? Just, you know, some people she's met on the island. She deliberately says people instead of women. She went out with them last night. Maybe it's a good idea to let Dad think Mom might be hanging around with other men. And, come to think of it, Mom did look great this morning, for a change, when he showed up to get Tess. She's still heavier than usual, but she always gets a nice deep tan, and she was wearing makeup and that cool hemp ankle bracelet Debbie helped her pick out. Tess felt a pang when she saw it. That kind of jewelry reminds her of Heath. The mere thought of it does again now, but she pushes Heath aside. Tyler, whom she hung out with last night at Beth's, is pretty cute, even though Beth says he's way too young for them. She's got a crush on one of the lifeguards, who has to be at least 18. But Tyler seems like he might be kind of interested in Tess. And he's nice. And after what happened with Heath Pickering, Tess thinks it might be nice to be the older woman with the upper hand. Not that anything's happened with Tyler, or is about to. Who are these people? Dad is asking, frowning a little. People? The ones your mother's going out with. Oh, right. You know, just people. Tess grabs her menu again, not wanting him to press her too hard. Can I get an appetizer? Sure. A pause. Then Dad asks, Did she meet them at the beach, or? On second thought, Tess talks over him. I don't think I'll get an appetizer. I'll save room for dessert. I feel like something chocolate. Normally, Dad would say, That's strange. You don't look like something chocolate. But he just nods and looks lost in thought again. Tess sighs to herself. This long weekend is truly going to be a long weekend. Chapter 11. Leah Roby. The name and her exact age, 13, helps fill in part of the puzzle Cam has been carrying around in her head since May. Unfortunately, the puzzle is far from completed, and the rest of the pieces are missing. So is Leah Roby, a sweet-faced blonde pixie. She was last seen getting off a school bus in a Philadelphia suburb, carrying a purple backpack and wearing a white blouse, knee socks, and a black watch plaid uniform. She was also wearing a silver MedAlert bracelet, warning of her severe nut allergy. No mention is made in the flyer of the distinctive shark's tooth pendant, the one Leah wore in Cam's vision, and the one the red-headed girl was wearing both in her vision and just now, in real life. What are you doing? Cam turns to see Debbie and Jonathan watching her. Oh, this girl. She looks familiar. Who does? You mean the girl in the poster? Debbie sounds as if she's decided Cam really is crazy. And Jonathan, without benefit of sunglasses to mask his expression, rolls his eyes. Who cares what anyone thinks? Cam reaches out and tugs on the flyer. It comes free easily, stuck there with masking tape whose glue is probably melting, along with everything else in this heat. What are you doing? Taking it with me, she tells Debbie. So I have the number, just in case. You honestly saw that girl? Where? You wouldn't believe me in a million years. I don't remember. Somewhere, she tells Debbie, who tilts her head dubiously. I'm sure it'll come to me. Let's see her. She holds the picture out to Debbie, who studies it without removing her shades, then shrugs. I don't know. She looks like anyone else, don't you think? What do you mean by that? Cam is feeling prickly, and not just from the heat. I mean, it's not like this girl has warts or three eyes or whatever. A lot of kids look like her, so you're probably thinking of someone else. Probably. Cam's tone is short. Why did she think it would be a good idea to make new friends, or look up old ones, for that matter? She doesn't need to listen to stupid comments, or answer questions, or worry that someone's going to figure out that she sometimes sees people, children, who aren't really there. But the red-headed girl, just now, was really there. And the little girl she saw cowering in that cellar somewhere really exists, and is missing. Did you ever have any doubt? Cam folds the exposed part of the tape over, pressing it against the back of the flyer, then folds the sheet in half twice and shoves it into her pocket. She looks up to find Debbie still watching her. What? She asks, wishing she hadn't come. But if she hadn't come, she wouldn't have seen the redhead or the flyer. She was meant to come. Things happen for a reason. Who were you chasing after just now, that you thought you knew? Debbie asks. Not the same girl? No, that was someone else. She shifts her weight, uncomfortably aware of Debbie's hard stare from behind the sunglasses. Come on, Mom! Can we please just go play golf? Jonathan asks impatiently. All right already, Debbie snaps. Let's get it over with. As they make their way toward the blue building with the red bubble letters, Cam searches the crowd, hoping for another glimpse of the girl with the silver shark's tooth necklace, and wondering what it means. As she turns on to Dolphin Avenue, Kathy has yet to come up with a plausible reason for being here on Long Beach Island. Vacationing? Why wouldn't she have mentioned that before? Polite concern as an AA sponsor? Would anyone really go this far out of the way for that? Visiting family? She doesn't have family, not real family, not anymore. Cam doesn't know that, but business? What kind of business would one have on a resort island over a holiday weekend? Pure coincidence? Come on. Slowing the car as she spots the familiar cedar-shingled cottage ahead, Kathy decides to wing it when she gets inside, which isn't her style. But here she is, almost helplessly drawn to Camden Hastings, for reasons she'll never be able to confess. A man steps out of the house just as Kathy pulls up to the curb two houses away, keeping a wary distance. Kathy watches him scuttle toward a junky car parked in the driveway, head bent furtively, as though he's not supposed to be here. He almost looks like... Can it be? Yes, that's him. Ike. Fancy seeing you here, after all these years. Through narrowed eyes, she watches him get behind the wheel and drive away. She waits a moment, then, on a whim, decides to follow. Early evening sunbeams slant across the grassy, rectangular National Mall in the heart of Washington. As the holiday weekend kicks off, it's crowded with tourists and impressive security detail. Tess and her father make their way across, heading toward the stately museum buildings on the north side. But it's still early, and Dad found out from their dinner waiter that the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History is open for another hour. What do you think? He asked Tess. Want to go? Stuffed, after a 1.5-pound lobster and chocolate mousse, she would have preferred to go back to the nice, air-conditioned hotel room and climb into bed with a book. But since her father has apparently decided to put aside whatever has been bothering him, the least Tess can do is humor him, even in this muggy heat and relentless sun that have her feeling sticky and gross. Not that it's likely to be much cooler in the shade. Tess thinks longingly of the beach as she feels around in her purse for the packaged wet wipe she pilfered from the lobster dinner. If she was at the shore with her mother, she'd be diving into cold waves right about now. "Look at the way the light is hitting the Washington Monument and the Capitol building," her father comments as she mops her forehead with the wipe. "You have your camera with you, right?" Yes, she has her camera bag tucked into the bottom of her purse, not that she was planning to use it. But her father doesn't need to know why she brought it along. Too bad he won't just leave her alone for a minute so she can take care of business. "Why don't you snap some shots?" Dad prods. Gazing from the impressive dome on one end of the mall to the distinct towering white obelisk on the other, Tess decides it is pretty photogenic. She gingerly reaches back into her purse and unzips the camera bag, not wanting to pull it out and take any chances of her father seeing what she has stashed there. "Have you been using the camera?" he asks as she sets up the first shot. "Yep," she lies. She snaps again and again, and suddenly misses her mother, who is sure to want photographic evidence of everything. "Smile, Dad," she aims the camera at him, and he obliges. He looks good in his black Maui Jim sunglasses and the navy Ralph Lauren polo shirt Tess wound up getting him for Father's Day. Well, Mom actually picked it out. Tess didn't have the heart to go shopping after what happened at Lily's. She'll show Mom the picture of Dad in the shirt, so she'll know he liked it. Probably a lot better than he would have liked the puka shell necklace Tess originally wanted to buy for him. That makes her think of Heath Pickering, which plunks her back to reality with a sad, sick feeling in the pit of her stomach. "It's too hot to stand here taking pictures," she says, abruptly closing the camera lens. "Can we go now?" The nice thing about Dad, as opposed to Mom, is that he tends not to read anything into what Tess says and does. Mom would detect distress in her voice, look closely at her, and ask her what's wrong. Dad, however, just shrugs, and they're on their way. "This is going to be great," he tells Tess as they climb the wide steps with roughly a million other tourists, by Tess's estimate. "You love dinosaurs."
"I do?" she asks crankily.
"Don't you?"
"I mean, I like them, I guess, but..."
Tess wipes sweat off her cheeks and decides Washington is the most humid place on Earth. Why are they here? "I remember when you were obsessed with them. You wanted everyone to call you Steggy."
"Steggy?"
"As a nickname." They trail the line of sweaty people heading into the museum. "Steggy, short for Stegosaurus."
"I don't remember that. Are you sure it was me?"
"Who else would it have been? Ask Mom. She'll tell you."
Mom, not your mother.
Tess feels a flutter of hope, and the crankiness subsides a little.
"How old was I?" she begins, to keep the promising conversation going. "When I wanted to be Steggy."
"Oh, I don't know. 4, maybe 5? 7?
Mom might know."
"She might." They inch closer to the door and air conditioning.
"So did you guys call me Steggy?"
"Sure, for a while."
At last, they've reached the entrance, and what Tess sees inside makes her legs go limp.
"Have your bags open, please," a uniformed security guard announces from the head of the line. "All bags, briefcases, purses, and containers need to be searched."
Tess clutches her purse close to her side, feeling as if she's going to faint and wishing she would. Anything to keep her camera bag out of the security guard's hands. Pacing barefoot across the small living room, Cam sips from a cup of ice water and tries to calm down. The heat and the stress aren't good for the baby. She forces herself to sit on the edge of the couch, directly in the warm breeze from the floor fan. Setting her cup on the table, heedless of the wet ring it will leave, she sees the marble notebooks. There was no need to put them away when she left with Debbie. It wasn't as if Tess or Mike were going to come along and find them. Mike. This morning's unpleasant little conflict has been all but forgotten at this point. Cam spent the past few hours pretending to focus on mini-golf, all the while keeping an eye out for the red-headed girl. She never saw her again. But the effects of the bloody premonition didn't subside. If anything, the sense of foreboding has grown stronger by the minute. When Debbie asked why she was so quiet in the car on the way home, Cam feigned an upset stomach. That was preferable to bringing up the missing child poster again, which Debbie and Jonathan seemed to have forgotten.
"You don't look good. Have you eaten shellfish?" Debbie asked promptly.
"You should never eat shellfish in this heat." Cam pretended that she had, and Debbie chided her. Then she reminded Cam again about her barbecue tomorrow.
"You coming, right? You have to. I won't take no for an answer."
"In that case, I have to come, I guess." But a barbecue is the last thing on her mind now. Restless, she stands and paces again, running through what happened at the miniature golf complex. It's no accident that she spotted the redhead, alive and in person, moments before seeing Leah Roby's missing child flyer. Chasing the redhead led Cam right to Leah Roby's picture. Both girls were wearing the same unusual necklace. That means, in Cam's logic, however skewed it might be, that the two girls are connected somehow.
Somehow?
One is missing, the other about to go missing, if she hasn't already. And if her instincts are correct, they have even more in common. Is the same person responsible for Leah Roby's disappearance planning to abduct the redhead? Never before has she had two visions coincide this way. What are you going to do about it? If only she knew where to find the girl, the redhead, tonight. But she hasn't a clue. She could be anywhere. Maybe she's left the island, Cam tries to convince herself, standing in front of the screen, facing out into the street. So what if she has? That doesn't mean she's escaped an ugly fate. The aura of danger about that vision is too strong to ignore. Long blue shadows of dusk are falling over the island. Soon it will be dark. A dog barks in the distance. A motorcycle guns up the boulevard. In a neighboring yard, an illegal firecracker whistles and snaps. Children shout. Nothing good's going to happen after dark tonight. The sultry air is weighted with a palpable mantle of foreboding. Cam turns away from the window, not sure whether to wish Tess was here, under her roof, or to be glad Tess is a safe distance from the island. At an explosive report from outside, she jumps, gasps, presses her hand to the base of her neck. Some kid with firecrackers again. That's all it is. Better get used to it, or it's going to be a long night. No. It's going to be a long night, no matter what. Because Cam is certain that whatever is going to happen will happen here, on the island, tonight. Her only relief is that it's not going to happen to Tess. Mike has maintained a stony silence from the time he and Tess left the museum. Now, with the door to his hotel room closed and bolted, he turns to his daughter, knowing he has to say something. Nothing that comes to his mind seems suitable.
"Can I go into my room?" she asks,
eyeing the closed adjoining door.
"No. Sit down."
Tess refuses to make eye contact as she sits on the edge of the bed and fusses with the straps on one of her sandals.
"Tess?"
"Yeah?"
Her head is still bent. He can see that her hands are shaking.
"Look at me."
She does. Her eyes are shiny.
"Damn."
He finds himself longing for Cam's presence as he asks,
"How could you do this?"
"I told you."
"No, you told the security guard. He bought your story. I don't."
"It's the truth."
Her tone is defiant, despite the shaking and tears.
"I don't believe you."
"Why not?"
That question and the tremble in her voice gives him pause.
Really, why doesn't he believe her?
"Because she's 14. Because I'm not naive. Kids her age lie,
and sneak around, and drink and smoke and do drugs and have sex and cheat and steal.
Come on, not all of them.
Surely not Tess, formerly known as Steggy, a sweet, obedient little girl living happily with two parents under one roof.
You always told me to tell you the truth, Dad, about everything. You said honesty's the best policy, and I listened. Why don't you believe me?
He shrugs. You're thinking she's lying because you actually buy into the that's-what-kids-do stereotype, aren't you? And because she's been moody and remote.
So what?
You're looking for evidence that your moving out has sent your baby girl down a bad path? Is that it?
Maybe it did.
Mike rakes a hand through his short hair.
Who the hell knows?
Or maybe Tess really is telling the truth.
How is he supposed to know?
He hates that he's here alone with her in a hotel 200 miles from Cam. He hates that what happens next is solely up to him.
Sit down. He pulls the chair away from the desk and gestures for her to take it. While I call your mother.
Why do you have to call her?
Because she needs to know what happened.
Why?
This is serious, Tess.
So you're going to put it all on Mom? Make her deal with it as usual?
Mike goes still. Cam's words, spoken weeks ago, when Tess's friends pulled some kind of prank on her, hurl back at him.
You just don't get it, Mike. You don't get it because you're not here.
Well, he does get it. Now. This is what it's like for Cam. Spending day after day, night after night. A single parent.
Yeah, he sees Tess, but not enough to be there every time a difficult situation arises. Not enough to really get it, the way he used to. If he and Cam stay on the path they're on, living separate lives, this is how it's always going to be. Not just with Tess, but with the baby. Right from the start. He'll never know his second child the way he knows Tess. The way he knew her, anyway. Not anymore. He can go on like this and let his daughter and his wife, and yeah, his new baby, become strangers. Or you can go home, where you belong, and work it out. That's what Cam wants. But things would have to change. She'd have to let me in. She'd have to stop hiding, tear down those walls. She's already stopped drinking. That's a huge step in the right direction. But she didn't even tell him about the baby. For more than 3 months, she didn't tell him.
Can you blame her?
Yeah, I can. She should have known I'd come back if I knew. She should have believed in me. She should have trusted me. That's the problem, right there. Cam doesn't trust him, not entirely. She never has. Right from the start, she's always held back a little piece of herself. Gradually, it became a big piece, the whole damned thing. He doesn't know why. He supposes it has something to do with the way she grew up, her mother leaving, sister's suicide, father's aimlessness. Still, she should have trusted me. I was always there for her. I loved her. I love her. Her and Tess. And this unborn child.
Yeah? So what are you going to do about it?
The Long Beach Township Police Department is on Long Beach Boulevard, so close Cam could walk there if she wanted to. She doesn't want to. She doesn't want to be here at all. But she forces herself to climb out of her car in the parking lot, and she forces herself to walk through the dusk toward the entrance. It's the right thing to do. Just stay calm. Stay focused. Breathe. Her sandaled footsteps slap against the warm asphalt. From the adjacent Little League field comes the sound of a bat cracking a ball, met by cheers from the onlookers. Cam would give anything to trade places with the parents hanging out in the stands, watching their kids play ball on this hot summer night. They're the reason she's doing this, though. The parents who turn their backs for seconds, minutes at a time, and the kids who think they're safe in this beautiful haven by the sea. They're not. Not tonight. Somewhere out there, she desperately hopes, is the girl Cam saw in her vision that day in her kitchen. Leah Roby, snatched from a suburban street 50 miles away. And somewhere out there is another girl, with red braids and sunburnt cheeks, a girl whose fate is drenched in blood. Once upon a time, Cam would have run scared, drowning the images in booze. Not anymore. With a trembling hand, she opens the door and walks into the police department. A uniformed brunette is sitting behind the desk, talking to a dark, handsome man who's leaning against it. They both look up. Cam wants to walk right back out again, but forces herself to approach the desk. Yes? The woman asks. Can I help you? From her purse, Cam pulls out the flyer with Leah Roby's picture, unfolds it, and holds it up. I need to speak to someone about a missing child. In Love Ladies, there are no motels to draw transient summer guests who tromp over the dunes at all hours. Here, there's just a stretch of homes, some of them grand seaside retreats, most privately owned by people who value the relative seclusion. This particular beach isn't deserted tonight, but it's far less populated than the beaches on the southern end. Here, away from the access paths, there's a long stretch of dark, empty sand. Down the way, in either direction, bonfires flicker. Children wave sparklers in the night. Roman candles soar to shower shimmers in the night sky. In the shadows beside a heap of sea-battered, washed-up wood, steady hands train the night-vision binoculars on the dunes. Every so often, a pair or group of strangers crosses the distant access path, their features startlingly distinct in the magnified infrared lens. She, however, has yet to appear. She should have been here 10 minutes ago. Did she decide to ignore the note sent with the shark's tooth necklace? Did her parents find it and forbid her to go out alone at night? Is she simply late? Amid the crashing surf, a snatch of distant laughter, guitar music, snapping firecrackers, whistling bottle rockets. Still, no sign of her. What if she doesn't come at all? She will. She has to. Be patient. When she arrives, everything will have to move swiftly. She can't be given an opportunity to flee. The moment she sees me, realizes who I am, she'll try to flee. That's how I should have known the other girl, Leah, was an imposter. She never recognized me. She was a total stranger to the end. How could I have made that mistake? It doesn't matter. The mistake won't be made again. This time I really have found her. Again, movement on the path between the parallel wood fences down the way. And then, all at once, there she is, emerging expectant from the dunes, red hair, expertly dyed, blowing back from a face that was obviously, cleverly, surgically altered. The masses of freckles on her face, her arms, even her legs, are impressively done. So impressively authentic-looking, in fact. What if it isn't her? What if this is another case of mistaken identity? It is. It has to be. And she's wearing the necklace, just as I told her. Good girl. The binoculars are swiftly tucked away. The syringe is produced and held at the ready. Just yards from here, up beyond the adjacent dunes, an SUV is parked on a remote stretch of road, waiting to take her away. There's always the possibility that someone will come along at precisely the wrong moment and see the girl being placed in the SUV. But it won't matter anyway. She'll be incapacitated at that point, and I'll explain that she's my daughter and fell asleep, and I'm carrying her to the car. By the time she's reported missing, I'll be long gone. Things are falling into place nicely. Here she comes, looking nervous, expectant. After all these years, she's almost within arm's reach. After all these years, she's mine again.
It's going to turn out to be the guy who runs the bumper cars. Rebecca Pearson is sure of it. She saw the way he looked at her the other day when she and her sister got on the ride, looked her up and down, gave a slow, appreciative nod. He was cute, in a grungy, carny kind of way. Ragged jeans, even in the heat, a backward baseball cap, and a 5 o'clock shadow. That was the clincher. The guys, ha, boys, back home, love to talk about shaving, as if they have anything to shave. This guy, the bumper car guy, her secret admirer, has to be at least 18. 18? And he went to the trouble of tracking down Rebecca, leaving her this really cool necklace, and asking her to meet him down here at the beach after dark, which took a lot of guts on Rebecca's part. Not that she's a chicken, not by any means, but she's never snuck out of the house before when everyone was asleep. "You're not really going to do it, are you, Becca?" her sister asked. "Sure I am, and you're not going to tell. You swear?" Nina swore. She's a good kid, when she's not accidentally erasing every song on Rebecca's iPod, which she did last month, causing Rebecca to stop speaking to her for an entire week. Okay, so where is this guy? Rebecca didn't think the beach would be this deserted late at night. It might actually be romantic if it wasn't so creepy. "But I'm not scared," Rebecca reminds herself as she emerges from the dunes onto the open sand. Not scared at all, she thinks, just as someone grabs her, and she feels a sharp stinging sensation in the side of her neck. Chapter 12.
"Here you go."
"Thank you." Cam accepts a plastic cup filled with water from the man who was talking to the desk clerk when she first walked into police headquarters. He introduced himself as Detective Randall Barakat. With his good looks, exotic blue eyes, unusual with such dark skin, he's got a lady killer aura about him. He brought her into this small interrogation room, took down her name and address, asked if she wanted a glass of water. She didn't, but she accepted, needing time to gather her thoughts. Now the water is in front of her on the table, and the nice detective is sitting across from her, and it's time to tell him exactly why she's here. After which, it'll be time for the nice detective to haul her off to the psych ward. "For God's sake, Cam, why didn't you just stay home and keep your mouth shut?" "Because the girl with the red braids is somewhere on this island, and someone is going to do something terrible to her if you don't stop her. That's why."
"Mrs. Hastings?"
"Mrs. Hastings. Yep, that's her."
When the detective asked her marital status, Cam said, "Married." It was easier. But, she realized, with a sick feeling in her gut, that the day is coming when she'll have to say, "Divorced."
"Tell me about the child," Detective Barakat nudges gently. "You've seen her?"
Slowly, she nods. Pen poised over paper, he asks, "And when and where was this?"
"I'm not sure."
"You're not sure when? That's all right. You don't have to be exact."
I mean,
she shakes her head, feeling sweat in her hair despite the air conditioning.
"I'm not just sure when. I'm not sure where."
He frowns.
"Excuse me?"
Getting nowhere, Cam is aware that the clock is ticking. She can't afford to waste time. It might be too late for Leah Roby.
"There's another girl," she says. "I don't know her name, or even where she lives, but she's in danger too."
"How do you know?"
"Just take my word for it."
She sees suspicion in his blue eyes and realizes immediately she's made a serious misstep.
"I'm not involved," she says quickly. "I'm trying to help."
"But you don't know her name or where she is?"
"No, but I can describe her."
She does, and the detective takes notes.
"And you know her how?"
"I don't, actually. I've just seen her."
"And you know she's in danger because?" Cam is silent. How can she answer that without possibly incriminating herself? He'll never believe her.
What are you doing? You shouldn't be here. This is wrong.
No, it isn't. It's right. I'm here because I'm trying to save a child's life and...
Mrs. Hastings?
Just tell him the truth.
How can she not? Then again, how can she? If she makes something up, he'll probably think she's lying.
Yeah, and if you tell the truth, he'll definitely think you're lying. Still, she's got no choice.
Taking a deep breath, she begins,
"This is going to sound crazy."
The detective gives a jaded, "I've heard it all," shrug.
"Try me."
For the second time today, Cam attempts to carefully choose her wording. For the second time today, she fails.
"I'm a psychic," she blurts.
Detective Barakat nods.
Nods.
Doesn't gape or laugh or shy away or pick up the phone and dial the psych ward.
No, he just nods.
He really has heard it all. Cam feels her body seem to ooze into her chair and realizes just how tense she was. Every muscle she has must have been clenched until this very second. Now her limbs and spine are pudding. The detective rubs his chin between his right thumb and forefinger, watching her thoroughly for a long moment.
"So you what? Had a vision of something happening to this girl?"
"Yes."
"What?"
"I don't know. Nothing specific. Just blood. I see her covered in blood, and I know it means something's going to happen to her."
For the first time, she sees a glimmer of doubt in his eyes.
"My visions used to be more specific years ago when I used to have them," she rushes on. "They always turned out to come true. I stopped having them for a long time."
"You don't have to explain the years of self-medicating, trying to shut out all those awful visions. He might really decide you're on something again." Then he says,
"There's someone you should talk to."
Lying awake in her hotel room, Tess is certain her father is lying awake in the adjoining one. The television's blue light flickers in the dark, the sound turned low. She put it on some late-night talk show, not because she's interested in any of the guests, but because anything is better than finding herself in total darkness and silence. She'd never fall asleep then.
"You'll never fall asleep now."
Dad doesn't believe her. That's what hurts. Does he honestly think, after all these years of watching her mother crawl into a bottle night after night, that Tess was planning to drink the vodka? Yes, she took the little bottle of Smirnoff's from Beth yesterday when Beth snuck into her mother's stash, pilfered from the airline. What was she supposed to do? Tell Beth she doesn't drink?
"It would have been the truth," a stern voice reminds Tess.
"Yeah, and the truth might have made Beth, her only friend, decide Tess is too young and sheltered to hang out with. And then where will she be this summer?"
"Alone."
"Which is right where she'll be in the fall, back home." So she pushed aside her conscience, took the bottle, and thanked Beth, who said it would help Tess get through a long, boring weekend with Dad. Back home after the beach, she knew she had to hide it from her mother. Not because she was afraid of what Mom would do to her if she found it, but because she was afraid of what Mom, faced unexpectedly with temptation, would do to herself. Tess had to get the vodka out of the house, so she hid it in her room, then smuggled it to D.C., where she planned to dispose of it in some garbage can first chance she got. A likely story. The museum guard didn't exactly say that, but he thought it. Tess could tell. Still, he confiscated the vodka, then let them go. They left immediately. Neither was in the mood for dinosaurs anymore. Tess wonders what her father would say if she asked him to take her back to Beach Haven tomorrow. Would he be hurt if she wanted to leave? Relieved? Maybe both. "He's done plenty of stuff that makes you feel bad, right?" That's what Beth said yesterday. And she was right. So why should Tess care about hurting Dad's feelings by telling him she wants to cut their trip short? He deserves it. That's what Beth would say. He got what he had coming to him, is how she phrased it the other day when Tess asked her why she doesn't see her own father anymore. He deserves to be alone and miserable for what he put us through. It's payback, she added almost gleefully. Payback. The problem is, Tess can't imagine taking pleasure in someone else's pain, especially someone she loves. When her cell phone vibrates in her back pocket, Lucinda has just taken the first sip of her second ice-cold beer, and the cover band is wailing a guitar riff halfway through Sweet Home Alabama. They aren't Lynyrd Skynyrd, but not half bad for a dive beach bar. She really doesn't feel like picking up the phone. There isn't a soul she really wants to talk to. Well, maybe there's one soul, but it belongs, along with his heart, to someone else. Heart and soul? Christ, one beer and you've turned into a total sap. Plunking down her wet green bottle on the sticky bar and rolling her eyes, she pulls out her cell phone and answers. Lucinda? Well, if it isn't the soul himself. And her heart, damn it, skips a beat. Why is Randy calling her at this hour? Did he forget that he has a wife? What's up? She asks over the music, wondering what she'll do if he wants to see her. She'll say no. That's what she'll do. That's the right thing to do. But he won't ask, because it all happened a long time ago, and they've both moved on. And if that's really true, what's she doing on Long Beach Island? Was it really a psychic vision about Leah Roby that brought her here? Where the skies are so blue, the lead singer booms. Randy, where the eyes are so blue, she thinks giddily, is asking, are you still here, on the island? Uh-oh, here we go. Lucinda considers lying. Maybe she should tell him she's back in Philly, because if she sees him, she's not sure she can stay strong. And if he's calling to see her, he's not so strong himself. But Lucinda can't lie, not because it's morally wrong, necessarily, but because the music is blasting, and this is an open-air bar, and Beach Haven isn't exactly a spread-out metropolis. It's a small town. Windows are wide open on this hot night, in cars, in houses. For all Lucinda knows, Randy can hear the strains of Sweet Home Alabama from wherever he is. I'm at the Rusty Anchor, she admits. That's about 2 minutes from here. Can you come? Tell him no. Remind him that he has a wife, and guess what? You have a life. Or go ahead. Tell him yes. It would be wrong. Highly inappropriate, to quote Bitsy Sloan. But when was the last time you did something just for the hell of it? Just because it felt good, and to hell with the consequences. Once upon a time, Lucinda Sloan lived her entire life that way. Not anymore. When were you happier? Then or now? Where are you? She asks Randy tentatively, toying with her beer bottle. Does your conscience bother you? The lead singer sings appropriately, and Lucinda wonders if it's some kind of sign. There are no accidents. I'm at work, and I've got someone here you need to meet. It's about that kid you're looking for, Randy says, and all inappropriate thoughts vanish from Lucinda's head. I'm on my way, she tells him, already heading for the door. I'm going to introduce you to an old colleague of mine, the detective informs Cam, sitting across the table from her again. Her name is Lucinda Sloan. Maybe you've heard of her? Cam shakes her head, setting down the water cup she just drained, again. Should I have? He shrugs. She's pretty well known in some circles.
She's a psychiatrist?
A psychiatrist? Randall Barraquette looks confused. Why did you think that?
Just a guess, Cam murmurs.
so maybe he doesn't think she's crazy. When he said there was someone he wanted her to talk to, that was her first thought. Lucinda has been working to find missing people for years now.
Oh, so she's a cop?
No. The detective shifts his weight, steeples his fingers, looks at Cam. She used to be, but now she's a psychic detective, I would call her.
So your friend has premonitions too?
I wouldn't call them. Well, a premonition is something that's going to happen in the future, right?
Cam,
apparently the newly anointed resident expert on the paranormal, nods. Well, as far as I know, he goes on, Lucinda sees things that have already happened. Usually people who've been murdered.
Cam considers that with a shudder.
She herself has always felt helpless about her own visions, but at least the calamities she sees haven't yet come to pass. At least there's still hope, a chance that she might be able to intervene. But if this Lucinda only sees violent events after they've happened, then for her, and the people in her visions, it's always too late. There's no chance of saving a life. No hope.
That has to be really hard on her, Cam murmurs, shaking her head.
She's a tough cookie. But it is. Because the thing is, she's never wrong. When she sees something, no matter how awful it is, it's for real.
So she lives in Beach Haven then? Or on the island?
No, in Philly. She's here working on the Leah Roby disappearance. She just came yesterday, so you have great timing. Cam nods. There are no real coincidences. Someone recently said that to her.
Who? Debbie?
Gwen? Whoever it was, they were right. I'm sure Lucinda's responsible for hanging that flyer you found, Detective Barricat tells her.
Why is she looking for Leah here, though, if she's from Philadelphia and Leah lived there, too?
Lived. Past tense, Cam realizes. Slip of the tongue? There are no real coincidences. Lucinda had a hunch that there was some connection to the island, I guess. I'm sure you understand.
Cam nods. She does understand. She has the same hunch. The thing is, she doesn't feel like Leah Roby is here, or even that she ever was. There's a connection, yes, but that's not it. She wonders if Lucinda would disagree.
I'll have to find out what it is that she sees, and how exactly she sees things in the first place, and about a million other things I'm dying to ask. A flutter of excitement darts through her at the thought of meeting someone else who can do what she can. That's never happened before. Almost immediately, her mind flits to her lost sister. As always, the thought of Ava brings with it a profound sense of longing. Cam knows her life would have turned out differently if her sister had lived. There would have been someone to talk to from the start, someone who understands what it's like to hear voices in your head.
Ava. Poor Ava. I'm lucky that the worst that ever happened to me was booze.
Cam could have ended up like Ava. She could be dead. There's a knock on the door. Detective Barricat stands and opens it. Hey, he says.
There you are.
His tone is gentler than it has been all night. He sounds affectionate almost, Cam decides as she takes in the willowy, gorgeous woman in the doorway. She has wide-set brown eyes, a full mouth, a small, delicate nose. Her hair is her most striking feature of all, tousled, long auburn waves that hang halfway down her back. She's wearing casual black cargo pants and a simple white cap-sleeved t-shirt that hugs her narrow waist and generous breasts. Suddenly conscious that her own white t-shirt bears a faint coffee stain, and that she hasn't combed her own hair since this afternoon, Cam thinks, I should hate her. Her next thought, as she watches Detective Barricat give the newcomer's hand a squeeze, is,
my God, he's in love with her.
It's not about his tone, or body language, or anything he implied when he mentioned her earlier.
Cam is going on pure instinct, but she's as certain as if the detective had just come right out and announced it. She isn't certain if he's ever acted on his feelings or whether they're mutual, but she doesn't miss the way Lucinda's eyes fasten on the detective's handsome face as he gestures her inside. Nor does she miss the gold wedding band on the detective's left hand as he closes the door behind her.
Thanks for coming. This is Camden Hastings. I think you'll be interested in hearing what she has to say.
Mrs. Hastings, this is Lucinda Sloane.
At last, Lucinda shifts her attention to Cam. Almost immediately, her eyes betray startled, disturbed recognition. Just a fleeting look, and then it's gone, replaced with a polite, if somewhat tense, smile, as Lucinda murmurs a greeting.
She saw something when she looked at me, Cam realizes, and a chill of foreboding creeps down her spine. She definitely saw something. Something that bothered her.
A steady line of headlights are aimed east over the causeway toward Long Beach Island, but there's little traffic headed in the opposite direction. It takes no time to get back onto the mainland, keeping the speedometer within 5 miles of the limit. Not that being stopped for speeding would necessarily give anything away. A glance at the back seat shows that she's still there, stretched out, eyes closed. A traffic cop peering into the SUV would see a worn-out kid who had too much sun and fun today. From here on in, it's smooth sailing, except for the slightest shred of doubt that just won't subside. It's not that she doesn't look like her, because aside from her build, she doesn't. That's a given. And it doesn't matter. It never did. It's not about looks. Looks you can change. I should know. It's more about a certain instinct. I was looking, and when I saw her, even from a distance, something clicked. Just like before? And all those other times? In all those other places? No, but this time I knew it was her. I just felt it. I was so sure I was right. Until the very last second, anyway. When she made eye contact just as the syringe went into her neck. In her eyes there was shock, horror, terror. But not a glimmer of recognition. Of course, that's probably because she was caught off guard. She was expecting someone else. Some secret admirer who had sent her a necklace and set up a romantic rendezvous on the beach. That's why she didn't realize it was me. But it's her. This time, it's definitely her. It has to be. While passing a truck, it's tempting to pick up speed and stay out in the left lane, tempting to race all the way home. But that's not a good idea. Better to pull into the right again and ease the needle back down to 70. A glance in the rearview mirror reveals a pair of headlights that just switched lanes, too, pulling in a little too close for comfort. Is it following? Nah. The car ahead is going a mere 55 and has to be passed. The car behind ventures into the left lane again as well, almost as if in pursuit. Paranoia? That's to be expected. After all this, it's probably nothing, but I'm going to make sure I shake those headlights before I get anywhere near home. That's for damn sure. I've got to get you home where you belong, little girl. It's about time, don't you think? No answer from the back seat. She's going to be out for a while. Well, that was a powerful sedative, and she's still a pipsqueak. When we get there, I think I'll light a nice fire. Oh, I know it's warm, but we won't let it burn all night. Just long enough. Long enough to make you mine. So you didn't feel that the cellar where Leah Roby was being held is on the island? Lucinda is determined to maintain focus on the matter at hand, despite her nagging concern over the stark, vivid image that struck her earlier when she first laid eyes on the Hastings woman.
No, I'm not 100% sure, but you know how it goes.
Lucinda nods.
Does she ever?
It felt like somewhere on the mainland, not all that far away, she goes on. You know, Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, maybe New York?
That's a lot of ground to cover, Randy pipes up, and Lucinda flashes him a look. I'm just saying.
Why don't we let Mrs. Hastings do the saying, she suggests, not wanting to intimidate the woman, who seems nervous enough as it is. She's actually squirming a little in her seat. Call me Cam.
Right, Cam. I'm assuming the digging you heard means she's buried somewhere? Randy asks.
I hope not, but it seems that way.
Cam rubs her eyes, looking wan. Clearly, she isn't used to being grilled like this. Lucinda gives her a lot of credit for holding it together this long.
Getting back to the necklace, Lucinda says. Leah's parents never mentioned that she was wearing anything like that. According to them, her only jewelry was a medic alert bracelet. We did find an empty jewelry gift box in her room, though.
Lucinda decides not to say anything about the sand particles in it, and hopes Randy won't either. Better to keep a few details private, just in case. Her instincts tell her that Cam Hastings is a trustworthy, upstanding citizen, though.
I'm thinking the necklace might have been in the box, Lucinda muses, propping her chin on her hand and looking from Cam to Randy.
And that whoever gave it to her
was the person who kidnapped her, Cam finishes the sentence, nodding vigorously. That's it. That's what happened.
Randy looks at her questioningly.
I mean, that's what I think happened, she amends, squirming again in her chair.
That's what I think, too.
Well then, Randy says with a shrug and a flash of his dimples.
Me three.
He's so damn adorable, Lucinda thinks, inappropriately. And so damn married.
Lucinda asked him about that yesterday. She had to, just in case.
Just in case what?
He was wearing that gold band on his ring finger for luck. When he awkwardly confirmed he'd married Carla, standing there in the salty sunshine, Lucinda couldn't help wishing a big fat gull would come along and crap all over him. For luck, of course.
Would you stop calling me that? My name is Rebecca.
You don't have to pretend anymore. I know who you are. Game over. Here. On the ground, her back pressed against the stone wall, the girl flinches in the flashlight's beam.
Don't touch me.
I'm not touching you, but I'm going to have to in a minute when I do your hair. Right now, I'm just giving you a bottle of water. If you don't drink water, you'll die. You don't want to die, do you? The girl accepts the bottle silently, with fearful contempt, yet a perceptible hint of defiance hangs in the dank air. Go ahead, drink it.
Is it poisoned?
Of course it's not poisoned.
Of course it's not poisoned?
The words are shrill with disbelief.
You kidnapped me. You injected me with something and knocked me out. You shoved me into this godforsaken hole in the ground, and you burned—
Shut up. She wisely clamps her mouth shut, but her eyes still blaze with disrespect. Little smartass. Drink the water, or I'll force it down your throat. And trust me, I won't care if you choke on it. Been there, done that. Not with water, though. Leah Roby. What a mess. One sad, sorry mistake from start to finish. She was the wrong girl. It's not as though she was targeted for murder, like the first girl in Santa Monica, and the ones who came after. Hers was an accidental death. No one could dispute that. She was allergic to peanuts. She ate peanuts. She died. Period. Died and lay here, rotting. For days until something had to be done. It wasn't a pleasant sight by then. Bloated with gas, her skin covered in blisters, fluids oozing from her eyes, her mouth, her ears. It wasn't as though she could be hoisted, carried up out of the cellar in one piece.
An old firewood axe, a couple of big black construction garbage bags, a wheelbarrow. It was a horrible, time-consuming job. What's left of Leah Roby is buried a good distance away, but the smell lingers. Stench this bad takes a long time to dissipate. There must have been another way. Not that it matters now. The girl, the right girl, lifts the bottle to her lips, her hand shaking so hard the water sloshes over the neck. It spatters onto the dirt floor. You're spilling.
So?
So you really shouldn't waste water.
So? Who cares?
Something is off about her. The attitude, the voice, what is it? Maybe nothing more than imagination. Paranoia again. It's been such a long time. Still, she was always strong-willed, but in a more subtle way. Now, even in the face of sheer terror, she's a brassy little pisspot, seemingly heedless of what can happen to her here, of the various punishments that would fit her particular crime. It isn't like her. She should remember. She should know this place. She might have forgotten, though how likely is that? She might simply have changed, not just physically. Still, frustration is beginning to slip in to snuff out the earlier euphoria at having found her at last. Wouldn't I perceive that it's her anyway, beyond a shadow of a doubt? Wouldn't I? Shouldn't I feel something? Looking at this girl who claims over and over that her name is Rebecca, it's impossible not to wonder whether she, too, is a mistake. No. Stop. Don't even think it. Just go on doing what has to be done. I have to brush your hair now. Put it back into braids.
What? You're not touching me, freak!
She glances up, the picture of defiance. On her forehead, the raw, fresh brand is clearly visible. Mine. That's what it says, only you were wrong. You know it, don't you? You don't want to admit it, but you know.
No, it's her. It has to be.
Oh, come on. She's an imposter. Again. Just admit it.
Can I ask you something?
Cam Hastings' voice interrupts Lucinda's thoughts.
Sure, shoot. When you have a vision, are you ever wrong?
Never, Lucinda answers promptly. In case you hadn't noticed, Lucinda is a very confident person, Randy says dryly, and she rolls her eyes at him. I mean, I might interpret something incorrectly, but what I see has happened. Or is going to happen, she adds uncomfortably. I thought you only see the past, Randy says. That's what I told her. In case you hadn't noticed, Randy is a very confident person. Lucinda shakes her head at him, and he throws his hands up, smiles, shrugs. Seriously, she turns back to Cam. In this line of work, what I see has usually already happened. But sometimes, of course, I have premonitions. It's not an absolute science.
I didn't think so, Cam sighs. I was just hoping maybe I was wrong about something happening to this girl.
Yeah, Lucinda lays a hand on her arm. I know it's hard.
Thanks, Cam clears her throat. Most people don't understand.
No kidding. Really? Lucinda manages a tight grin. She likes Cam. She's trying so hard to seem stoic, but there's a potent vulnerability about her. I wish I hadn't seen what I saw. I wish I understood what it means.
I'm sorry, Cam says, but I need to excuse myself to go to the ladies' room. I'm pregnant and...
She gestures vaguely at the empty water cup, then looks embarrassed. Hey! Congratulations, Randy says promptly. That's great. When are you due? Lucinda tries not to wonder if Randy and Carla have any babies. She couldn't bring herself to ask him about that yesterday.
Around the holidays?
Is this your first?
Randy asks. No.
Already at the door, Cam tosses back over her shoulder.
I have a 14-year-old daughter.
Those words sweep over Lucinda like a January gust.
A daughter.
A 14-year-old daughter. Now the puzzling, troubling vision Lucinda had when they met makes absolute sense. Of course, Cam Hastings has a daughter. And her daughter, Lucinda comprehends with grim, sickening certainty, is going to die. Rebecca jerks her head, hard, trying to free herself.
Let go of me, you freak! What are you doing?
Shh, just be quiet and let me do your hair. Her stomach lurches as she feels cool fingertips graze her skin. Loose strands are pushed back from her forehead, away from skin still raw and oozing from the hot iron held there until Rebecca thought she would die from the horror and the pain. Even now, she's certain she's going to vomit, especially feeling those fingertips stroking her wounded skin. Somehow, though, she holds back the wave of bile.
You can't lose it. You've got to stay in control.
Her life, she suspects, depends on it.
This can't really be happening. It's got to be a nightmare. It's too unlikely, too horrific, too surreal, she thinks, feeling bristles moving through her hair now.
The strokes are oddly gentle,